Today is November 8th, 2017, and this is episode number 436 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, and though I would like to be, I am currently not in Singapore. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
You know, I don't blame you for wanting to be in Singapore. It's, from what I understand, a really cool place. And
where all the cool kids are.
It's where all the cool kids are, which means you should actually be there.
I should. And you probably should too, but neither of us are.
Yeah. So that's really disappointing.
Indeed it is. You know what else is disappointing?
Geez, did you bring lunch? Because this is going to take a while.
I had something specific in mind.
Oh, okay.
And that's specifically the re-rise of the false dichotomy between privacy and safety when it comes to smartphone encryption.
So this is something we've talked about in the past, and I'll play Stringman for a minute. Brian, this argument discussion is coming back up again. What happened now?
Well, see, we did tell this. Let's actually start with the background, because this was the most recent time this has been a big discussion was during in the aftermath of the San Bernardino terrorist attack by Saeed Farouk.
And, yeah, and his wife Tashfeen Malik.
I don't remember her name.
I'm pretty sure that's it.
I don't remember her name, so I have no idea. And we, as we all know, we don't do research.
Well, you know, top men and all that.
Yeah, exactly. So the FBI had a phone, an iPhone, that was used by Farouk and was actually owned by his employer, which was a state agency.
Mm-hmm. San Bernardino County.
Actually, a county agency, a county health department, I believe. And they gave the FBI permission to get into the phone. The FBI could have gotten a warrant, but regardless, they actually had permission. It wasn't necessary because they had permission to get into the phone, because it was actually owned by this jerk's employer. Mm-hmm. And the problem is they couldn't, because it was locked. And so they asked Apple to help them, and Apple's like, well, we can't get in it. And the FBI said, well, get in anyway. And Apple said, well, you don't understand. We can't get in. And Apple's like, and the FBI is like, well, yo, dude, you got to get in it. We got to get into this phone. And the FBI took Apple to court, asking the courts to compel Apple to make a version of iOS that bypassed the encrypted security lock on the iPhone, this particular iPhone, mm-hmm. that they could then sideload so that they could open it up without permanently erasing it.
Right. And now Apple had, prior to all of this, cooperated with the FBI and had been able to recover data from the phone's iCloud account.
Yeah, from the iCloud. They didn't get it from the phone. They got it from the iCloud account, because Apple has the keys to the iCloud account.
Right.
Because that's the way that works.
But they wanted to see on the phone.
They wanted to see if there was any information on the phone. Now, Apple fought this court order. This court case, I should say. I don't think that the courts ever ruled on it, because the FBI ended up withdrawing its request when they found an Israeli company that they could pay $1 million to crack into it.
Right. And Brian, you actually were right. They fought the court order, because the FBI had obtained an order from a federal court compelling Apple to create what Apple nicknamed GovOS.
Oh, okay. But it was during the appeals process that the FBI dropped their demand.
Yeah. So you had it right.
That's a very kind interpretation, but okay. So
you just didn't realize you had it right.
And the Israeli company was able to get into the phone. They didn't find anything on it. It had been wiped, but that actually is immaterial, right? Whether or not there was anything on the phone is immaterial to whether or not Apple should be creating any kind of backdoor into iOS. And the reason is, and this is the thing that we've discussed so many times, that a backdoor created for one is available to all.
Right.
This is a hard and fast rule. There is no way around the laws of reality in this particular regard. And this is why Apple said that it would be an incredibly dangerous thing to create this version of iOS, that it would put all of their customers in danger, because there are a sea of assets, criminals, and state-sponsored actors around the globe who want nothing more than to be able to get into our phones. Maybe not your phone specifically, and maybe not my phone specifically, but in every phone that they can. And in the case of state-sponsored actors, oftentimes it's to spy, mm-hmm. or to repress, or oppress, actually. Mm-hmm. Surveil, in other words. Sometimes in the case of criminal organizations, it's just to be able to scrape any kind of data that they can use for their illicit profit. And this, the like I said, there's a sea of these people out there doing this. And it has long been understood by the intelligence community, by encryption experts, by, you know, mathematicians, that an encrypted communication infrastructure and encrypted communications and encrypted devices make us safer, make the United States safer than the United States would be if we didn't have those things.
Right. And a lot of people forget that you need to take into account all of the other things that we do that's encrypted beyond just storing data on our phones. We're talking about bank transactions, going to the grocery store and buying something with your credit card. These are all things that would be susceptible to hacking if there were government backdoors for encryption.
Yes. We fight this battle every few years, in part because politicians don't know, and in part because law enforcement becomes myopically obsessed. And this is extremely understandable. I'm actually not being critical here. I think this is a very natural thing. It's part of the human condition. But you know, law enforcement is charged with preventing crimes and sometimes in solving crimes. Mm-hmm. And it would be a lot easier for law enforcement to do both of those things if they had access to everybody's device, any criminal's device, if they could get a warrant for access to a device and they could get into it. That would make their jobs easier. I would also add that it would make their jobs easier if we just put cameras in every room of our home so that they could constantly watch everything that we do, and then later go through it looking for evidence of crimes. That would also make their jobs easier.
It would make their jobs a lot easier.
It would make their jobs a lot easier if every single device had tracking information that they could use. Actually, most devices do have some kind of tracking information or can be tracked one way or another. But, you know, goodness, wouldn't it be awesome if we just had the old clipper chip?
Remember that? I do remember that.
That was one of the last times this ideological fight was waged. This war was waged. It was the clipper chip back in the 1990s when the I think it was the FBI, but it might have been the NSA. I can't remember who wants it, because the NSA now acknowledges that we're better off as a nation with encrypted communications. Mm-hmm. And the intelligence services waged this battle for a while, but they eventually came to understand the reality too. It's politicians that don't understand it, and then, like I said, it's law enforcement, and they want to be able to do their jobs easier, and I understand that. As a matter of fact, I actually believe there should be attention between law enforcement and privacy. Both those two forces should be pushing back and forth against each other.
I agree with you. If there's not that tension, that means that at least one of the sides is being complacent.
Yes.
And that's not good.
The other side will go too far.
Yeah. So we need to have that tension.
For instance, it would be wrong if the FBI could no longer obtain warrants to, you know, get into our stuff. That would not be a good thing. That's going way too far on the side of privacy, just as a wild example.
Yep, I'm with you. Yeah, we need to have the warrant system so that there's a check and balance for government accessing personal information of any kind, which could be what's sitting in your glove box as opposed to what's on your phone. So it's hard to find the line, but this is one place where we know it's binary. If you're on one side of the line, you have encryption. If you're on the other side of the line, for all practical purposes, you no longer have encryption.
Right. For practical purposes. So this is the, you know, in tech terms, ancient history, that's the backdrop for what I saw happening yesterday, which is the return of this stupid argument. There was an FBI agent on the TV talking about having a smartphone from the and I forget his name and don't care about his name, the killer, the shooting massacre, the shooter in the Texas massacre in Sutherland Springs,
and
Texas.
You know what? I'm okay not saying his name.
Yep. Screw that guy.
Yeah.
And they have a phone. It's locked. They can't get into it. And they're complaining about it. And they're complaining about it in such a way that makes it seem like these protections shouldn't be there, that we shouldn't be able to encrypt our phones, that we shouldn't be able to log people out of our phones. And it's the same old thing that we saw from James Comey regarding the Saeed Farouk's work phone. And it's the same old thing that we've seen from other law enforcement people from various times when they complain about having smartphones and whatnot that they can't get into. And, you know, I would rather be safe from all the bad guys than not. And so the other thing that I saw happening was that I was watching CNN and the anchor, I think it was Brooke. What's her name? Let me actually get her name. CNN anchor Brooke. I think her name is Brooke.
She's going to be so disappointed when she gets her Christmas card from you and it has the wrong name on it.
Yeah, I know. It might not have been, I forget which anchor it was. It might have been Brooke Baldwin, but now I can't remember. And she was taking up the call. She was taking up the call. And, you know, she was basically reinforcing this false dichotomy that we should be choosing between encryption and safety. Privacy and safety, because it's a false dichotomy, because if we don't have the encryption, we're not safer. If the FBI has back doors into these devices, we will not be safer. We will actually be less safe. It's a false dichotomy. I hate seeing the press allowing that false, perpetuating that false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And it's super frustrating, and it's happening again, even now. We just went through this. It wasn't solved. You know, it's a drag that the FBI withdrew its case before it could be decided in appeals, because it would have been nice to have this settled. I think we said, you and I said at the time that this was going to come up again.
Yep. And here we are.
So I hate being right about that, but
yeah, no, I totally get it. And do we know at this point what brand phone was recovered?
No, the FBI guy said that he wasn't going to tell us which phone it was because he doesn't want to let the criminals know which phone they should get. To which I say, F you.
That's
jackass.
Stupid.
That is It is so, I mean, again, because in, you know, I get it. His job is to solve crimes. And his job in this case is to figure out why this madness happened, this insanity happened. I get that. And he wants to do his job, and he may have evidence right there in his hands, and he just can't get to it. I get how frustrating that is.
Yeah,
but you can't divorce that from the reality that encryption is binary. You've got it or you don't. And you cannot divorce it from the fact that these devices are connected. This is a worldwide network of devices. It is a playground for the bad guys to steal our data, steal our information, steal our photographs, steal our text messages, steal our banking data, steal everything that they can so that they can profit from it.
Mm-hmm. That's not a future that sounds palatable to me.
Well, it's
a future where everyone has to go back to using cash for everything.
It would be the end of civilization as we know it. I mean, I don't know that it would actually destroy all civilization. Maybe that's slightly hyperbolic, but it would certainly change the way we do things because, I mean.
Yeah, if I can't feel comfortable with the knowledge that my purchase and banking transactions are encrypted, then I can't feel comfortable using those systems for handling money.
Yeah, same thing with iMessage. Can you imagine Apple Pay Cash if Apple didn't encrypt iMessage end to end?
Holy crap, that would be horrible.
It would be a nightmare. It would be launched, and then everybody's money would be stolen, and then Apple would pull it.
Yeah, there you go.
So anyway, it's a false dichotomy. So I love General Michael Hayden. Do you remember him?
Yes, I do. He's been a voice of reason through all of this.
Yeah, he's well respected. He's a brainiac. He's a retired general, but he was head of the NSA. He was also head of the CIA, and I think he was also national security advisor.
He has some street cred.
Yeah, he's had three of the top intelligence positions in the United States of America, and he had when the San Bernardino case was going. He did many interviews. I think he might have been pushing a book at the time. He did many interviews where he explained that the intelligence community's assessment is that we are better, the commerce is better, that the United States of America is better with encrypted and protected communications.
Yeah. And better and, also includes safer, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And in this case, that would be synonymous. And in particular, the business is safer with encrypted communications, and that they acknowledge the fact that this makes their job harder and it makes law enforcement's job harder, but that on balance, the United States is better off with encrypted communications. And he's one of the few people that would make this case on the various talking head shows on all the networks. And, you know, we need more of that. And more importantly, we need journalists to get themselves some education on this so that they can push back when someone from usually law enforcement, but also some politicians say, actually, sometimes it's even rights, victim rights advocates who push for us losing these encrypted protections. Mm-hmm. They need to push back on it, and they need to not reinforce this false dichotomy. And, to a large extent, if you're listening to this right now and you see someone making this false dichotomy, push back politely.
Polite is a good tactic.
Yeah, always a good tactic. But especially in this pushback. Case. Don't let this stuff roll by. You know, this is a hearts and mind kind of thing. And one of the cases, one of the points I made in the column that I put up yesterday on this was that it's the knee-jerk reaction of course law enforcement should be able to get into our devices. That knee-jerk reaction is incredibly understandable. It's easy. It's a, you know, it's a very surface analysis, but it's one that is instantly understandable. I mean, it's like most of us, if law enforcement says, I've got the phone here of a terrorist or a mass murderer, and I need to get into it. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're going to say, my goodness, yes, you should be able to get into that. How dare Apple or Google or whomever, you know, Facebook or WhatsApp, right? How dare they keep you out of that? Oh, my God. Good. You know, oh, my goodness. We, you know, you could maybe solve this. You could maybe catch all the bad guys and stuff like that. It's a really understandable reaction. But deeper is better. And a deeper understanding on this is much better. And the deeper understanding is solid. But like, I mean, there's no arguing the binary aspect of encryption. There is no argument. There is no debate amongst the people who actually understand it.
That's an important point right there, amongst the people who understand it. The problem is that the arguments that are being presented and accepted by a lot of people are coming from places and people in authority positions who don't understand.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that I'm not making out these other folks as bad guys. Most of them have their hearts in the absolute right position. Like in the case of law enforcement, solving crime or preventing crime. You know, in the case of law enforcement hawks who are politicians, I'm looking at you, Trey Weirdo Gowdy. It's just this deep belief in law enforcement. And I get that gut level, that knee-jerk reaction that of course law enforcement should be able to get into these devices. I get that. But it's wrong.
Yeah. Yep, it is. And so now with the Texas mass shooting, right now we're at the point where we've had an FBI agent say, we have a phone, but they won't tell us which kind because
it's probably an iPhone.
Yeah, and they're saying
because if it was an Android device, they'd probably be in it already.
You know, I know you say that only partly in jest, but it's, yeah, I know it's true too. So, but we're the place we're at right now. The FBI, as far as we know, has not filed any court documents to try and compel a phone maker to unlock the device.
Correct. As far as we know.
Yep. So I'm thinking if it's an iPhone, they probably won't go for that because they already know how Apple's going to respond. But I wonder if it's, say, like a Samsung phone or HTC, you know, something like that. Would the FBI consider filing a similar request?
Well, I mean, listen, if the device is not, if a company holds the keys to the device, then they should respond to a warrant. I mean, Apple, if Apple held the keys to an encrypted iPhone and they were served with a warrant, they would turn those keys over. Mm-hmm. Right. The issue here is on end to end encryption or encryption where the device holds the keys, which is the case for iPhone locking. The key to unlocking an iPhone is on the iPhone. It's not stored with Apple.
Right. Apple's actually not involved in the process of generating those keys. It's the two devices that are communicating.
Yeah. Or in this case, the device, if we're just talking about a lock screen.
Yes. Yes.
So if they had an Android device that wasn't, and most Android devices that are new today that are running the most recent versions of Android, they are also encrypted with on-device encryption. And Android, Google is using a lot of end-to-end user encryption too. So I'm not saying that they're inherently flawed. Well, they are inherently flawed because they're running Android. But my point is that if it's another device for a company that does own the keys, then that company should and most likely would respond and open the device.
Yeah, that seems totally reasonable. It's
and they should.
Yes, as long as the warrant is valid and not overreaching.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the problem is when when a valid warrant is being served for something that the company can't do, like Apple can't unlock a phone, or if they get a court order asking for a back door to be created, that becomes a danger to us all. Those yes. are the problems.
Yes.
But like if Apple if this Texas shooter has data on his iCloud account and Apple can get to it, they were served with a warrant, then they would and should turn it over. They should and would.
All right. So what about the argument that came up when the San Bernardino iPhone was the thing the FBI was focused on, where they said that this hackable operating system wasn't going to be used for anything else, that Apple could just keep the code and that way it would be safe. How do you feel about that argument?
Well, I that argument doesn't hold any intellectual water whatsoever. For one thing, if it exists, it will eventually be exploited. And if it exists and is sitting on a phone that is within the FBI's holding, not Apple's holding, I don't see how that could possibly be within Apple's care. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the thing is that when a backdoor is created, it is in this case, if Apple created what we were calling FBI OS or government OS, mm-hmm. I personally like FBI OS, but everyone else is calling it Gov OS.
Yeah, it's because that's the one that Apple came up with.
But yes, I'm with you. They probably didn't want to have the iOS in the other one. Yeah. Always careful, Apple. But if government OS was created and Apple had it, someone within Apple has access to it. And if someone within Apple has access to it, they are subject to extortion, threats, mm-hmm. bribes.
A mistake.
Like, for instance, the mistake that the NSA contractors, which I think may have been the same Israeli company.
When they left.
When they left all that data, all the NSA cracking tools sitting on a router somewhere.
Right? I believe that was Cellebrite that did that.
Yeah. I mean, like, smart people also make mistakes. Careful people also make mistakes. And if that OS is sitting on a device that's in the FBI's care, it could be stolen, mishandled, a mistake could be made, et cetera. I mean, like, Apple's argument, and it's an argument that I buy, is that the mere existence of government OS is a threat to everyone who would have an Apple device. And I buy into that. I buy that argument.
Yep. And I'm with you. I think that merely the fact that something like this exists, hypothetically, is in and of itself such a great threat that it should not exist.
Correct. I agree. All right, listen, we beat this. We actually went a little long on it.
Yeah, but it's a really important topic.
Yeah, by the way, I talked a little bit about this with John Martellaro, and he interviewed me for Background Mode this week. It'll go live on Monday, I believe.
I'm so glad he interviewed you. It's at first because when you get to be interviewed, it's always interesting. Do you remember when I interviewed you?
For what?
I did a whole series. Clearly, you don't remember. I interviewed you on Daily Observations. I was doing interviews with authors and musicians.
Was I there for that?
Believe it or not, it was a really great interview.
Well, thank you. I'm sure. Let's go with that.
So, but where I was going with that, oh my God, Brian, where I was going with that was from experience. I can say that, that you are great as an interviewee, and knowing how John, handles his interviews on background mode, I'm sure it's going to be a fantastic episode.
Oh, thanks, man.
Even though you won't remember it.
Yeah, Mac, Adam insists I was on MacCast once. I don't think that that's true.
That's really funny. All right. So podcasters out there, if Brian has not ever been on your show, let's start gaslighting and everyone start telling him about the time that he was on your show.
That's so mean.
Yeah, but Brian, here's the great thing. You totally know I just put that out there. So now, anytime someone talks to you about when you were on their show, you're going to question it.
It's like a double mind effing.
That was a horrible thing for me to do.
That was. You're an awful, awful person.
Sometimes. When it's funny, that's when I'll be awful.
Well, fair enough. Fair enough. So I think we had another topic. We were going to talk about the Paradise Papers.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that.
The Paradise Papers, first off, that sounds like really nice. Like I'm picturing Mr. Rourke, and it just sounds like a fun thing. But it turns out that's not the case.
Well, I personally am certainly massively torn on it. I mean, so the Paradise Papers is a leaked or stolen cache of documents, some 13.4 million documents that were turned over to, let's get the name of that organization. It's an organization of journalists. 380 journalists have been poring over this, this document. Let me find it here. From the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. The documents were turned over to the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung, something to that effect.
Holy crap!
Süddeutsche Zeitung.
It sounded like you actually knew what you were doing when you yelled at.
Yeah, I did not. So anyway, German newspaper, they're the same newspaper that originally was given the Panama Papers, which were a similarly leaked / stolen cache of data. And considering the fact that these documents are coming from two different organizations at this point, I would assume it's someone like Anonymous or some other social justice warrior hacking group that hacked. Most of these documents came from a law firm called Appleby. They're an offshore law firm that handles money for the rich and powerful and, you know, famous and whatnot.
So that's probably a pretty good gig for them.
Yeah, it's probably a really good gig for them. And so 13.4 million documents, 380 journalists have been poring over it over the weekend. So one of the initial stories involved the Trump administration cabinet member, William Ross, I forget his first name, who is the Commerce Secretary. And he apparently has retained ties to a shipping business that is directly connected to Vladimir Putin's inner circle.
Whoops.
Yep. But you know, all kinds of revelations in these documents. And the reason why I'm torn on it is because, like, on the one hand, they're bringing to light things that maybe should be brought to light. On the other hand, they are stolen. You know, and we don't like it when our documents are stolen. I'm not sure that we should necessarily be happy about it when someone else's documents are stolen. Mm-hmm. In the case of Apple was one of the other headlines because it was revealed that Apple had moved a company, an Irish subsidiary, to the quasi-nation of Jersey, which is a Channel Island. It's a crown protectorate in the English Channel, that has its own parliament, and they don't charge corporate income tax. So it's a popular haven for corporations.
Okay.
Right. And you know, the thing that Apple actually released a 1200 word document defending itself, you know, basically giving its side of the story about this Jersey Island business. And Apple's case is, well, first of all, we told Ireland and the US and maybe the EU that they had moved this company to Jersey. So it wasn't like it was a secret. And that furthermore, it didn't change their tax obligations to any government, including Ireland.
So what Apple's saying is they've been transparent about what they're doing with their money that is, or the revenue that's generated outside the United States and where they're moving it around.
Right. So all the headlines about Apple coming out of the Paradise Papers were essentially, they were all basically accusing Apple of being slimy and shifty and skirting the law. And I don't think that's accurate. I've talked a lot about wanting Apple to pay its fair share of local taxes, mm-hmm. Regardless of whether or not there's a way for it to pay less. There's a line in the sand. I don't want Apple to give all its money to governments. That's certainly not what I want. I just think there comes a point where you don't need to find yet another way to not pay a local taxing district. Yeah. And I think that Apple found that particular line a long time ago. And yeah, so I mean, that's my take on it. Other people will say that Apple has a fiduciary responsibility. This is actually legally true. Apple has a fiduciary responsibility to find every single loophole that it can to minimize its tax burden. I think there's a point beyond which companies ought to do what's right and not look for that other loophole.
Yeah. Well,
a lot of people disagree with me on this.
Now, Tim Cook, he's been very open about his feelings on the tax laws, which can be summed up as, look, if you don't like the way that we're managing our tax responsibilities, then why don't you change your laws so we manage them differently?
Yeah, there's a line before that he says. He says, we follow the law. So if you want us to do things differently, change the law. Mm-hmm. And that's because Apple gets accused of it's really weird. Like, do you remember when the Senate brought Apple? Senate, it was a subcommittee or a committee, I forget which, brought Tim up for a hearing.
Oh, yeah.
It was two or three years ago.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were accusing Apple of getting up to shenanigans. The funny thing is that Apple doesn't get up to shenanigans for the U.S. It's outside the U.S. where Apple is actually getting up to legal. You can't really call them shenanigans because it's legal. So
legal shenanigan like activity. How's that sound?
Yeah, it's not really shenanigans. I mean, everything Apple does appears to be legal. I would be flabbergasted. I would be flabbergasted if Apple was ever even accused, let alone found guilty of actually breaking a tax law. I would be flabbergasted if that was the case. I think that Apple is scrupulously legal. That's my guess.
I'm betting you're right. And I'm not saying that because I'm putting Apple on a pedestal here. I'm saying it because it's just really pragmatic. When you're a company that makes as much money as Apple does, when you're in the spotlight the way Apple is, when it comes to financial stuff like that, man, you walk the straight and narrow with staying within the boundaries of the laws. You go right up to the edge, but you are not going to do anything wrong.
Right. So the thing that Apple is great at is routing its profits to offshore, routing its profits from offshore operations and revenue, mm-hmm. to offshore countries that don't charge corporate income tax. And but when they do that, they still owe tax money to the U.S.
But not until that money is brought into the U.S.
Right. And that's why they work so hard to do this, because they can keep that as long as they keep that money offshore, they don't ever actually have to hand over any tax money. Now, what Apple does is they set aside money to go with those tax burdens, mm-hmm. those tax obligations. But guess what? Apple gets to keep earning money on the money that they set aside because they haven't paid it yet. Mm-hmm. So this is why Apple works so hard to do what they call the double Irish, or the Dutch sandwich with the double Irish, where they, like, you know, let's say that there is a subsidiary in Germany. There is a subsidiary in Germany, Apple mm-hmm. Germany, and Apple Germany is selling products, and it's selling products through Apple stores owned by Apple Germany. Well, Apple Germany gets those products. They actually license those products from an Irish subsidiary mm-hmm. at a very high rate, very, very high price. Mm-hmm. So they don't actually make all that much money in Germany, even though they're selling, you know, a bunch of Macs and iPhones and iPads and whatnot to Germany, right? They're not actually making any profit in Germany because they're paying such a high licensing rate to themselves in Ireland, where Ireland doesn't charge very much for corporate income tax.
Right. Okay. So in that way, Apple is able to keep the revenue they generate from those sales secluded from the United States.
No, because they actually still owe all that money that they're not paying to Ireland for income tax. Mm-hmm. They still owe to the U.S.
Right, but not until the money's brought into the U.S.
No, nope, they owe it, but they don't have to pay it until it comes back.
That's
the difference. Yeah, that's a very, very, very distinct difference there. Okay. So anyone in the U.S. complaining that Apple is hiding money offshore is flat out wrong. They're not hiding it from the U.S. They actually want to owe it to the U.S. because they don't actually have to pay it. And inside the U.S., they pay billions every year in taxes because they're not offshoring their money.
Right.
And people, you know, especially Apple haters, often have not even a surface understanding of all this. And so they like to say that, you know, Apple is offshoring money, but Apple is not offshoring money. In fact, they're working overtime to make sure that they owe money to the U.S. offshore. But it's U.S. money is not being routed offshore. It's only outside the U.S. where the money is being routed mostly to Ireland and now some to Jersey. And then they do this thing in between New Zealand and in Australia, too. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really sure what they're doing in Asia, to be honest, but I'm sure they're doing something similar, as close to it as they can in Asia. So, yeah. So there were lots of articles accusing Apple of shenanigans here when Apple's not really up to shenanigans. They're just following the law.
Yeah. And whether or not that seems palatable is a completely different thing. But they are acting completely within the law.
Yes, they appear to be.
Yeah,
and I would be flabbergasted if it ever came out that they weren't.
Same here. This is just the kind of thing when you're as high profile as Apple that you do not mess around with.
Right, and when you're as high profile as Apple, you will be the target of articles like what we saw coming out from New York Times. I think the Washington Post, the BBC, probably the Guardian. I didn't see one on the Guardian, but I'd be, again, flabbergasted if the Guardian didn't have something. There were lots of articles about this, making it a big deal out of this Jersey deal. And to be fair, Apple clearly takes this seriously. Apple put out a 1,200-word document defending itself. When have you ever seen Apple do that?
That really surprised me.
Yeah, never. I've never seen Apple do something like that.
Yeah. So Apple's clearly taking an aggressive defensive stance on this. And my guess is that they feel it's necessary to do this posturing They wouldn't just on a whim say, "Oh man, bad press. Let's write a 1200 page."
Right. 1200 Apple's word. Apple's usual reaction to bad press is a statement at best. You know, one paragraph statement at best, usually.
Yeah.
In this particular case, they're being there were a couple of aspects of Apple's 1200 word document that I didn't think were true on the surface, but I thought, again, deeper is better. Deeper probing and deeper understanding of what mm-hmm. they were saying is probably would probably reveal a slightly different take. But mm-hmm. But the point is that they were definitely aggressively defending themselves.
Yeah, and it comes down to if governments don't like how Apple is paying their taxes and how other corporations are paying their taxes, then change the laws.
Right. And but now that said, it becomes a little bit tricky, if not impossible, when a country is willing to take a hit in order to get business that they wouldn't otherwise get.
Like Ireland.
And so now, why would Ireland want to change its laws? Ireland is benefiting quite lovely from having Apple do all this business there. Apple has 6,000 employees in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And Apple is paying a very, very low tax rate on a lot of money, a lot of profits, mm-hmm. very low tax rate. But that's money that Ireland wouldn't have if they weren't playing this game. Ireland has no incentive to change this. As a matter of fact, they have every incentive to continue it. So, you know, you can't, it's one thing to say governments should just change their laws, but it's the mere fact that governments can change their laws that is actually at the root of this issue overseas. In the U.S., the United States actually has nothing to complain about. As a matter of fact, the United States, the IRS, I think it's the IRS, it might actually be one of the international taxing authorities within the United States government, came out in Apple's defense against charges of shenanigans by the European Union.
Wow.
Well, because they want that money owed to Apple.
Or they want to owe to the United States.
Thank you. They want Apple to continue to owe that money to the United States. And everything that they're not paying tax for in Ireland or Germany or anywhere else in the EU is money that they're going to owe to the United States, and the United States would like to keep that very much. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure they would.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know, it's all tricky. Oh, one last thing about the Apple's defense. They mentioned that Apple has been in Ireland since 1980, mm-hmm. when Steve Jobs set up the subsidiary there. And it's kind of like I felt like they were like, you know, dragging out Saint Steve, you know, like, you know, even, you know, Saint Steve himself was involved in this. So, you know, why would you criticize us?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. That's kind of funny.
That was my take on it. You know, they included a nice picture of, a bearded Steve Jobs in 1980, looking over the shoulder of looks like an Irish manager and an Irish worker on an assembly line, because Apple used to make a lot of stuff in Ireland.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, huh? I do like that photo.
It's a great photo, but yeah. I don't really think it's pertinent to the case.
Yeah, but I suppose if you want to. You know, if you want to try and spin everything as positive for yourself as you can, and you're Apple, you at some point can just drop Steve Jobs in the middle of it, and now it has a magical take.
Yeah. One more last thing about Paradise Papers and Apple's defense. Apple says that it's paid $35 billion in taxes overseas in the last 3 years alone, mm-hmm. and set aside an additional $36 billion for money owed to the U.S. And again, that's one of those things where a little surface digging is good, because Apple has set aside $36 billion to the U.S., but it will never, ever pay it at least not pay that a full amount, mm-hmm. because that money will never come back into the U.S. until either a law forcing them to do so is enacted, or some kind of massive tax break, tax holiday is enacted that would allow them to bring it in for a zero or reduced rate.
Yeah, or a change in tax laws.
Right. Yeah, that's the short version of what I just said. Yes.
Yes.
And so, you know, Apple says that they've Apple saying that they've set aside this $36 billion is somewhere between half the story and disingenuous, because it's never, ever going to pay that $36 billion. And that's part of the entire point.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of money, man. So,
yep. Lots of money.
We have like 10 minutes left. Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked at all about the iPhone X.
Well, yeah, and this has sort of been the Brian show. So since I don't have an iPhone X, why don't you like lord over me how much you like or dislike your iPhone X?
I like my iPhone X. It's really cool. I like my iPhone X, and you don't have one too. How is that?
I do not. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. My delivery date, you know, I tell you, so my delivery date is between the 17th and the 24th, because I didn't order. I was ordering it wrong.
Clearly.
And because, you know, I got to say, I'm keeping this Brian show for a moment longer. This is the first year when the carriers are able to get phones to people faster than Apple could.
You know, yeah. I
and,
was,
and that's the thing. We both ordered through AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
And you got yours on the 3rd. You actually ordered yours after mine, right? You got yours on the 3rd. Now, I ordered through AT&T, but I did it through Apple. So I did it on AT&T's plan, but I did it through Apple's mechanism, because that's what I've always done, because that's always been the fastest way to get a phone in the past. This time around, it wasn't. And you got your phone, and I'm still waiting.
You know, I've had really good luck with my past couple iPhones ordering directly through AT&T instead of Apple. Mm-hmm. And the iPhone X, just same thing. So, yeah, and I had horrible trouble, which I've talked about on TDO. The short version is AT&T servers were overloaded. My initial order didn't go through, but it kind of went through, and so I had to start the process over. And so when I actually placed my order, it was an hour after pre-orders started, and I was still able to get my phone on the 3rd.
Yeah, Bob Levitas ordered his from T-Mobile at 10 a.m. Central on Friday morning, and he got his on the 3rd too.
Yeah, so that's got to be salt in the wound for you.
And mine is scheduled for between the 17th and the 24th. And it's weird, because no matter how many times I reload my order status page, that date doesn't change.
That's really weird. Have you cleared your cash?
Right? Yeah. I must be reloading it wrong.
Yeah.
Because I thought that if you reloaded it enough, that it eventually would show up faster.
but you would think.
Would think.
Well, it worked for me, because I didn't really believe I was getting my iPhone X on November 3rd until it actually happened, because AT&T was showing my my phone as order processing all the way up until Thursday, the 2nd. Mm. And then all of a sudden it was like, you'll have your phone tomorrow. But that's just how they do it. It's not like there's anything weird happening. Their system is just very myopic like that.
Yeah.
Well, so here's what you can expect when you get your phone. You're going to be surprised at how fluid everything feels. It's fast. It's smooth. And that screen is so responsive, so it just feels like everything has been lubricated very nicely, and it just hums. So that's really nice. The OLED screen, I think it looks nicer than the LCD screen. Whoops, okay. I turned that phone over. This is a problem I have. There's too many things on my desk right now for testing, but anyhow, I think the screen does look better on the iPhone 10 than it does on the iPhone 7. And you're going to adjust to the gestures far quicker than you expected. And if you have issues with Face ID, like I did, my guess is after 2 days, everything's going to click in your brain. The new neural pathways will have burned. And then you just get it. And Face ID suddenly works all the time.
Okay.
Yeah. And the cameras. Oh, you are going to like these cameras so much, you may want to date them.
All right. What have you... We've seen reports of people breaking these things. Do you have a case on yours yet?
Yeah. Actually, what I did, I picked up my iPhone and... When I went over to the Apple store to do my setup there, just in case something went horribly wrong. And when I took it out of the box, my first thought was, I cannot leave the store with this not in a case. Mm-hmm. And Apple there, they just had a horribly poor selection of cases. So I put it back in the box, drove over to Best Buy, which did have a really good selection of cases, bought a little $20 case and put it on, went back to the Apple store and finished the whole setup process. And I will not have this phone naked ever.
That makes sense. I've got, I had my Apple leather case delivered because Apple likes to tease that way.
Yes.
And then I got cases from Mujo. Some leather cases from Mujo that were sent for review. And then I got the rock case from Wood Life, W-U-D with the umlauts over the U. Mm-hmm. And then one of their wooden cases too. I just don't have a iPhone to put them in yet.
Yeah. And I'm on the other side of that. I have an iPhone, but the cases I'm going to test haven't arrived yet.
Right.
So, but
if we lived closer.
If we lived closer, we could coordinate.
Yes, I could just like say, here, put one of these on.
Yeah, but the case that I picked up, I really like it. I think it was $19, and I think it's the company is Insignia.
Okay,
and it's just this thin plastic shell. It's black that goes around all the edges and has a tiny little lip so that. If you sit your phone face down, the glass isn't touching the table.
Okay.
And it didn't add noticeable weight or bulk to the phone. So I have this $20 case on my phone that is setting a bar that's actually pretty high for all the other cases to meet or beat.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. I'm wondering if I'll end up putting a drop case. Like on my iPhone 7, I'm using the wooden back case from Xtoria. I've used the spec the Mighty Shell. Is that right?
Okay.
Does that ring a bell?
That sounds right.
I've used that in the past. I really like just having a simple leather case. I really like Apple's leather case, for instance. I love everything that Vaha Cases does.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that I would really long term trust my iPhone 10 to a leather case.
It depends on how it's made. My 7 right now is in an OtterBox case that it's one of their more streamlined models. So it's not like I'm carrying a brick. And I went to that because Apple's case, leather case, doesn't have anything at the bottom edge. And I dropped my phone and broke the screen when it landed on that edge.
Yeah.
Which just, it was so sad. It's the first time I've ever broken an iPhone screen. And I love that case. I love Apple's leather case, but without any protection on the bottom edge, I had to stop using it.
Yeah. I'd love to hear from our listeners, what kind of cases they're using. You can write us at ACM at MacObserver.com. What kind of cases you're using in particular for the iPhone 10. And, I'd love to hear what the crowdsource thought is.
Yes, please. Yep. And we just ran out of time, Brian.
No, we did. You know, I should confess something though.
Okay.
I finally allowed myself to fall into the world of fidget spinners.
Well, I know you well enough that I feel safe in asking, how many do you own now?
just two so far. But I got an 8-minute spin time with the second one.
Is this the one that you showed me, the red one?
No, the red one, the most I've gotten out of that one is a little over 5 minutes.
And, okay, so you have a new one that's an 8-minute spin.
Yeah, it's heavier. Is I think one of this uses the same bearings, but it's slightly larger and definitely heavier, so it keeps going. Yeah, so anyway, that's my confession for you today.
Okay, so someone, see if there is a fidget spinner app for the iPhone. And if so, send Brian a link so he can have a fidget spinner on his phone all the time. He can just flick on the screen.
So I do. I also have the cheap one I got at Pepcom.
Uh-huh.
That, which is what, which finally suckered me into this. And then Parallels gave me a pin that has this fidget spinner on the end of it. So I guess I have four. Uh-huh. But only two real ones. I'm such a dork.
All right. Well, now I know what we can expect the booths to hand out to us at CES in January.
Yeah, fair enough.
You're going to come home with so many fidget spinners.
I don't know. I immediately became a snob.
Yeah.
It's kind of how I roll.
I know. Well, but you know, when they hand you the cheap fidget spinner, you can say, oh, that's not a fidget spinner. And then pull out yours.
Well, that's not a fidget spinner. This is a fidget spinner.
There you go. Yeah. And then you can shame them at their booth for the present that they tried to give you.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, we have a game plan for CES. That's good. Yeah. All right. That ridiculous note.
On that ridiculous note. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
And hey, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer. Spinning it now.
I have an iPhone 10 and you don't. I have an iPhone 10.